for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States is seeking a diplomatic solution to the conflict in eastern Ukraine.
We want a diplomatic resolution, but we cannot close our eyes to tanks that are crossing the border from Russia and coming in to Ukraine. We can't close our eyes to Russian fighters in unmarked uniforms crossing the border.
Kerry made his comments after meeting today in Kiev with Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko. Meanwhile, French President François Hollande says he and German Chancellor Angela Merkel will visit Ukraine to present a new solution to the conflict. The two will then go to Moscow for talks with Russian officials. The Yemen branch of al-Qaeda says one of its top commanders, Harith al-Nadhari, was killed in a U.S. airstrike in the country's south. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula said in a statement posted on Twitter that Nadhari and three other militants were killed while traveling in a car last week in the southern province of Shabwa. Cameroon says at least 91 civilians have been killed by Boko Haram since the Nigerian militants invaded Cameroonian villages on Wednesday. Defense Minister Edgar Alan Ngoz told VOA six Cameroonian soldiers and 13 Chadian soldiers were killed in fighting militias in and around the border town of Fotokol. The minister said at least 500 people have been wounded and said the death toll may increase because most of the wounded have not been taken to hospitals. Chad and Cameroon have deployed troops to fight Boko Haram. I'm Dave DeForest. This is VOA. AFP quotes government officials as saying Niger's parliament has scheduled a vote for Monday on sending soldiers to join the fight against Boko Haram. A parliamentary source says Niger will send troops to Nigeria to fight the Islamist militant group. The government of Zimbabwe is denying that President Robert Mugabe fell yesterday shortly after returning from a trip to Ethiopia. The Associated Press quotes a government spokesman as saying the president broke his fall. Airport witnesses reported seeing Mr. Mugabe fall as he was stepping down from a platform where he had given a speech. Press photographers said they were forced to discard their photos of Mugabe's fall. Images obtained by the Associated Press show the president falling and landing on his hands and knees. Tunisia's parliament has approved a coalition government. The new government will be led by the Nida Tunis Party, but will include ministers from other parties. This is the first government to be formed after the country's first free presidential and parliamentary elections last year. Reuters reports that the International Monetary Fund is faulting the Pan-African lender Ecobank Transnational for poor governance and too rapid expansion. The IMF said these pose serious concerns about possible reckless lending at the bank's Nigerian subsidiary. The comments are found in a report about banks operating across African borders. Jordanian warplanes launched airstrikes against Islamic State targets today, that coming a day after the country's king vowed relentless targeting of the militant group following its killing of a Jordanian fighter pilot. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Iran's Foreign Minister Javad Zarif will meet in Munich Saturday. They will discuss negotiations on Iran's nuclear program. The German and Greek finance ministers met in Berlin today. They made no progress toward settling a demand from the Greek government to restructure the country's bailout. German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble said afterward that he and Greek Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis had agreed to disagree about France's call to end strict austerity measures imposed in exchange for nearly $300 billion in loans over the last several years. Varoufakis contradicted Schäuble's comment, telling reporters, "We didn't even agree to disagree.
We didn't reach an agreement. It was never on the cards that we would. We didn't even agree to disagree from where I'm standing. From where I'm standing, we agreed to enter into deliberations."
That was Yanis Varoufakis. European stock markets are mixed at this hour. Asian markets closed mixed today. I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
A new report says too often a child's survival depends on place of birth, parents' income, and ethnicity. Save the Children calls it an unfair lottery of birth that violates every child's right to an equal start in life.
That's VOA's Jody Kapawa reporting. Details coming up.
Also, Cameroon says at least 91 civilians have been killed by Boko Haram since the Nigerian militants invaded Cameroonian villages yesterday.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Boko Haram extremists returned to the town of Fatakol in Cameroon today and killed as many more 90 residents. Cameroon's Minister of Communications, Issa Choroma Bakari, says an estimated 800 militants attacked the town. A local survivor says the militants slit the throats of many residents and burned homes, churches, and mosques. He says the massacre occurred after residents refused to join Boko Haram. Chanian troops had repelled an attack on the town by Boko Haram yesterday. More than 70 residents died in that raid. Bakari says Chad troops killed more than 50 of the attackers. The AU is meeting today to complete plans for a joint force of 7,500 regional troops to combat Boko Haram. Nigeria, Chad, and Cameroon now operate across each other's borders in fighting Boko Haram.
Chadian troops have played a decisive, if at times problematic, role in at least two African conflicts in the past few years, Northern Mali and the Central African Republic. Some analysts say they may be the region's best hope to turn the tide against Boko Haram, but others are more cautious. And look, files from VOA's West Africa Bureau in Dakar as African leaders prepare to set up a 7,500-troop regional force in which Chad will take a leading role alongside Cameroon, Niger, and Benin.
Chad is taking the fight to Boko Haram in Cameroon and in Nigerian towns along the border. Analysts say Chad could tip the balance against Boko Haram. Just don't expect Chadian troops to stay for the long haul.
Le Chad souhaite faire une opération rapide contre Boko Haram, une opération coup de poing.
Central Africa Director for the International Crisis Group, Thierry Vieux-Culon, says Chad wants a blitz operation, like a strong punch, fast and hard. He says that's evident in the large number of troops and aerial support Chad has deployed. He says the Chadian army runs into logistical trouble with longer deployments. In northern Mali, he says, we saw Chad struggling to resupply and even pay soldiers. This is the third time in 2 years the Chadian army has ridden to the rescue of its neighbors. The two other interventions, Mali and the Central African Republic, had wildly different outcomes. Chad withdrew from Mali in a blaze of glory, having played a decisive role in retaking the north and crippling AQAM terrorists during the first 3 months of the French-led intervention in 2013. A year later, Chadian troops pulled out of the CAR amid a hail of accusations that they had been too cozy with Seleka rebels and that they fired on civilians. They were even accused of firing on fellow African Union troops. Analysts say the risk of indiscipline is all the more reason Chad may want to keep this operation short.
Disons qu'ils sont pas, c'est pas une institution à l'armée tchadienne. Donc, c'est des bons combattants.
Central Africa expert at the Paris-based National Center for Scientific Research, Roland Marshall, says Chadian soldiers are good fighters. As the French military says, they are warriors. He says they are very good in battle. They are not so good at what comes next, stabilization. Chad President Idriss Deby has pumped the country's oil wealth into the military. People cheered as Chadian troops rolled into Cameroon, awash in vehicles and weaponry. President Deby said simply that Chad cannot remain indifferent to Boko Haram. Many see in Mr. Deby's decision an implicit displeasure with the Nigerian military, which has lost key towns and vast swaths of territory to Boko Haram since 2013. Boko Haram has become a regional menace, launching attacks in Cameroon and threatening trade routes to N'Djamena. Nigeria insists that this is a joint effort and that it is still running the show, but analysts are skeptical. Analyst Jean St-Pierre runs the Berlin-based security firm Mossacon. He says there's another question to consider when gauging Chad's potential impact, not just how long, but how far.
How deep within Nigerian territory will Chadian troops be allowed to go?
And how deep is Chad willing to go?
Is that more of a containment approach right now? Sort of saying, okay, well, just make sure that the borders to Cameroon, to Niger, to Chad, that Boko Haram is contained within Nigeria.
Mossacon tracks the Boko Haram insurgency closely. St-Pierre says Boko Haram appears to have pulled much of its force away from the borders, but still out of easy range for the Nigerian military. Anne Luck, VOA News, Dakar.
Past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. New cases of Ebola in West Africa have increased for the first time in a month, and the World Health Organization is concerned that the approaching rainy season could make it harder to contain the disease. WHO reports that weekly figures for new cases in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea jumped from 25 to 124. Health officials had been successful in significantly lowering numbers in late 2014. More than 22,000 people have been infected in the epidemic, and about 9,000 have died. Local officials also worry that many of the new cases cannot be traced to people known to have been infected. Also, about one-third of Guinea's prefectures report residents who refuse to cooperate with health workers. Officials continue to discourage the traditional washing of the dead, but a dozen new Ebola cases occurred after a January funeral.
The virus continues to spread to new areas of Guinea close to the Mali border. Mali, which was declared Ebola-free several weeks ago, has stepped up border surveillance. In the first encouraging report for a treatment for Ebola victims, health officials in Kakadu, Guinea, indicate trials of a drug show promise. The trials are being conducted at the Doctors Without Borders Treatment Center by researchers from Guinea and France. French government officials report that the trials show a reduction in the number of deaths and faster recovery rates among 80 infected adults and children. Results have not been published yet. The drug is called Avigan and is manufactured in Japan.
A new report says too often a child's survival depends on place of birth, parents' income, and ethnicity. Save the Children calls it an unfair lottery of birth that violates every child's right to an equal start in life. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Save the Children CEO Carolyn Mild says in many countries, a child's survival is a matter of chance.
We looked at the implications of child survival across 87 countries, actually, in this report. And what we found was the most deprived kids, those in sometimes rural areas or at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder, those were the children that were dying at the highest rates.
The report, The Lottery of Birth, says in 78% of the countries studied, at least one social or economic group is being left behind. In 16% of the countries, the report finds inequalities in children's survival chances increased across all the groups for which data was collected. But the report says there are countries already trying to close the equality gap.
When they did that, when they actually made parity between, for example, the poorest and the wealthiest kids, they actually dropped mortality rate faster. We need to worry about the most deprived kids. And actually, when we do that, our progress on something like child survival can actually be faster. So that's the real nut of this report.
Much progress has been made over the years in reducing child mortality rates. Save the Children says currently 17,000 fewer children die every day compared to 1990. And the under-5 child mortality rate has been cut nearly in half. But Miles says many children still don't have an equal chance to survive. The worst child inequality is found in sub-Saharan Africa. She says focusing on the most deprived kids levels the playing field.
Rwanda is a really good example, Malawi, another good example, where governments have really focused on the poorest, the hardest to reach kids. They've made great progress on dropping child mortality, so saving more kids' lives, and they've closed that equity gap.
Miles says giving all children an equal chance to survive should be part of the Sustainable Development Goals. The SDGs will replace the Millennium Development Goals that expire at the end of this year. She says the goals should focus on programs known to boost a child's chances of survival.
Common diseases are still killing many kids in the developing world. So vaccination campaigns that actually reach some of these hard-to-reach areas, they might be in the rural areas, they might be in deep urban slums, but making sure that when we do vaccination campaigns, we're looking at reaching every child. So that's one example. Undernutrition is a big factor in child mortality, and so making sure that those nutrition programs, again, are getting to all children.
The Save the Children report encourages governments to spend their own money on child survival programs and not simply rely on donors.
We have seen real progress in places like Ethiopia, for example, where the government has made a huge commitment to child survival. And they have funded tens of thousands of community health workers to be in villages and towns where the health system doesn't get to. And it's resulted in much, much better child survival rates in Ethiopia, for example.
The report recommends universal health coverage to ensure that poor and marginalized groups have access to quality services. Save the Children says its ultimate vision is a world in which no child dies from preventable diseases, no matter where they are born or who their parents are. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehisu Heap, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Cameroon says at least 91 civilians have been killed by Boko Haram since the Nigerian militants invaded Cameroonian villages yesterday. And African leaders prepare to set up a 7,500 troop regional force in which Chad will be taking a leading role alongside Cameroon, Niger, and Benin. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The International Organization for Migration, IOM, says more than 400,000 people remain displaced by violence and insecurity in the Central African Republic. The organization says their Return Intentions survey conducted in November 2014 found insecurity in the place of origin, food insecurity, limited access to work, and overall economic vulnerability as reasons for the continued displacement. Torsten Hashens is chief of mission for IOM in CAR. He provided insight into the challenges of tracking displaced people in the Central African Republic.
The actual displacement figures, internal displacement in the country, are about 400 to 410,000 still. So from the original 1 million, displacement is down to about 400,000. Plus there are about 400,000 refugees from CAR that reside in the neighboring region. So if you look at Bangui itself, all the places in Bangui right now reflect the figure of about 50,000. If we add those additional places, Boda, Cabo, Moy, and Tido, we have this 54th figure.
What other regions of the country are people displaced?
In different regions across the country, mostly in those areas where the fighting took place. It is not only Bangui, but also Bambari, Kagabandolo, Batangafo, Boa, Beberati. So these are various parts of the country, basically the central and western parts, where international community to have a clearer picture by doing more precise local assessments in cooperation with the local authorities. However, most of the figures that are being published and that the international community works in are still estimates. Only here in Bangui we have a very, very clear picture because people live in collective IDP sites, plus there are estimates of people who live with host families.
What are some of the challenges that you all are facing in trying to track displaced people in the CAR?
If you want to have a complete picture of internal displacement, so there's basically three issues. One, in Bangui, you have collective displacement sites, for example, the airport. About those collective sites, we have a figure which is more or less 50,000. Then the second group is people, internally displaced people that live with host families. Host families are families that are either friends, relatives, or complete strangers who have accepted to take on IDPs in order to give them an alternative to living in camps. So those, about those families, we have estimates, but no precise figures. And then the third group is the displaced people that live in the countryside. And altogether, the estimates are between 400 and 410,000 at the moment.
At this point, what is being done to help return some of these people back to their homes?
There are several initiatives going on. There is the constant gathering of information about the situation at the former communities of origin. There is spontaneous go-and-see visits that the people undertake by themselves, going back to the neighborhoods, asking the neighbors what has happened, what is the situation, looking at their property. There is in the countryside, where the situation is a bit more complicated, there are organizations that are arranging go-and-see visits for groups of IDPs to their former community, and there is some kind of socioeconomic incentive operations, if you want to call it like this, ongoing, where organizations are trying to promote return by either offering improvements to the shelter if the former house has been damaged or looted, which is very often the case. Then there is assistance available to replace the roof, to replace the doors, the windows, and some essential items. This has helped some of the IDPs to take the return decision. Much more needs to be done generally, as the figure of 400,000, the remaining reflects is the need to intensify those measures that effectively promote return. But it should also include advocacy and, on the political side, also the creation of conditions that allow people to feel safe enough to return. And this includes also the presence of the security forces, the presence of the state, the presence of the state of law and justice system, which are equally important. And this cannot all be done by the humanitarian community, but it also needs to be done by the state itself and by the international United Nations military and civilian forces here in the country.
That was Torsten Haschens, the chief of mission for the International Organization for Migration. He spoke with me from Bangui.
Pope Francis has ordered Roman Catholic clergy not to protect priests from sexual abuse charges and to make protection of children a priority. In a letter addressing pedophilia in the clergy, Pope Francis wrote that there is absolutely no place in ministry for those who abuse minors. The pontiff sent the strongly worded letter to the heads of the National Bishops' Conference and religious orders. He wants close and complete cooperation to a new child protection watchdog group he recently created. The Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors meets for the first time tomorrow. The commission is led by American Cardinal Sean O'Malley. It includes both clerics and lay people. Two of the members were victims of pedophilia priests.
Well, most young women who are at the highest risk of contracting the AIDS virus do not use drugs designed to prevent HIV infection, even when they're offered. That's the conclusion of a new study that looked at so-called pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, in thousands of women in Africa. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Among those who take PrEP every day, the risk of HIV infection is greatly reduced, up to 92% lower compared to those who do not use pre-exposure prophylaxis. The strategy is also not nearly as effective among people with HIV-positive partners who do not take it consistently. The study of about 5,000 women in Uganda, South Africa, and Zimbabwe looked at their use of the antiretroviral tablet Truvada, or a generic version of the medication called tenofovir, and a vaginal gel made of tenofovir. 3 months into the study, the blood results from nearly 650 women indicated a majority were not using their assigned product, whether it was the oral or topical medication. Those who were least likely to take the drugs were women under the age of 25, the ones at highest risk of contracting the deadly virus. Despite the fact that most of them claimed enthusiastically that they used the medication regularly to protect themselves against infection by an HIV-positive husband or boyfriend, the blood samples indicated otherwise. Only 25 to 30% of young women had detectable levels of tenofovir or Truvada in their systems.
It was a, I would say, a very, very unexpected, sobering, initially incredibly depressing results.
Jeannie Marazzo, the study's lead author, points out that in addition to being the mainstay of PrEP, Truvada and tenofovir are used to treat HIV. Marazzo, a professor of infectious diseases at the University of Washington in Seattle, says many of the women felt stigmatized using an AIDS medication.
Many women said things like, well, you know, if I bring this product home and my boyfriend or my husband sees it on my counter, then they're going to automatically think I have HIV and that's it for me. Other women said, you know, I really can't be seen with this because people are going to think that I'm taking it because I'm at risk for HIV, and that's just not okay.
The research, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, found the overall incidence of new HIV infections was 5.7%, nearly twice what researchers expected. But among younger women, up to 10% of participants became infected at some study sites in South Africa. Marazzo says her findings are a game changer, hopefully leading to more effective strategies to prevent HIV transmission.
It's really changed the way prevention studies are, I think, going to be done. And it's not just going to be for HIV. It's going to be for anything that's in very healthy people. Because really healthy people, you know how it is. You know, you don't really think bad things are going to happen to you until it's too late, right?
Another trial involving a cervical ring embedded with antiviral drugs is underway to see whether women are using them correctly and consistently to prevent HIV infection. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiyus Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butter here to remind you that February is Black History Month in the United States. And starting February 2nd, we'll begin our Black History Month series and daily quiz on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African-American and African individuals and events. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your answer. We will select a winner each morning from among the correct answers.
Thank you.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Cameroon says at least 91 civilians have been killed by Boko Haram since the Nigerian militants invaded Cameroonian villages yesterday. And African leaders prepare to set up a 7,500-troop regional force in which Chad will take a leading role alongside Cameroon, Niger, and Benin. Coming up, we'll have music from Sierra Leone. And in our feature segment, China signs a deal to develop road, rail, and air transport routes to link African capitals. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhi, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand some Nations Cup football questions tops your sports report.
Kim, will it be a border football war between neighbors Ghana and Ivory Coast in Sunday's Nations Cup final? Or will host Equatorial Guinea's national team, nicknamed the National Thunder, storm into the championship match with another surprising victory? Well, we'll find out the answer to those questions later Thursday night in Equatorial Guinea's capital, Malabo. That's where at 1900 UTC, the National Thunder of Equatorial Guinea will host the Black Stars of Ghana, with the winner advancing to Sunday's title game against the Elephants of Ivory Coast. Equatorial Guinea has already achieved its best ever Nations Cup showing by reaching the semifinals. Ghana, meanwhile, is a four-time Nations Cup champion, but its last trophy came way back in 1982, before all the players on the current team were even born. After losing its opening Nations Cup match to Senegal 2-1, Ghana has bounced back with victories over Algeria, South Africa, and Guinea. Ghana's assistant coach, Maxwell Kunedu, says the Black Stars have a good attitude right now under Israeli tactician Avram Grant, the team's head coach. Assistant coach Kunedu talks about Ghana's preparation ahead of this evening's semifinal in Malabo.
The preparation is quite different this time around. That is why some of us believe that we're going to do a very good job, because we've been around for some time, and before us, we didn't know what happened. But for the past 2 years, we've seen how the team prepares before the fifth game, as you said. But this time around, Mr. Avram Grant, my boss, has brought a lot of a different dimension altogether. So we'll try to seize the opportunity to at least advance.
If the Black Stars of Ghana do advance, it'll set up a rematch of the 1992 Nations Cup final in Senegal, where Ivory Coast edged Ghana 11-10 in a marathon penalty kick shootout. In Nations Cup action Wednesday, Ivory Coast advanced to the championship match with a victory over the Democratic Republic of Congo, as we hear now from our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Auma.
Ivory Coast beat the Democratic Republic of Congo 3-1 in their semi-final in Bata on Wednesday. African Footballer of the Year Yahya Toure, Gervinho and Serge Kanon scored for Ivory Coast, while Diomassi Mbokani converted a penalty for the Congolese. Although victorious, Ivory Coast's coach Hervé Renard says there is still room for improvement before the final.
I think we didn't do all the things very well. We were sometimes too easy. Maybe we didn't respect sometimes the opponent. I always said this team came back from behind against Congo-Brazzaville. Maybe the players are not listening, but you have always to be careful when you have a player like DRC in front of you. We are in the final. This is the most important, because, you know, after five games, sometimes the team are tired. So the most important is to reach the final and to congratulate Congo, DRC for their tournament. We were in the same group stage. It was very tough. Congratulations to them, and we'll try to bring the the cup in Abidjan is the most important.
That was Hervé Renard, the Ivory Coast coach, speaking in Bata. In Malabo, Equatorial Guinea play Ghana in the second semifinal today, Thursday. Equatorial Guinea edged Tunisia 2-1 to advance to their first Nations Cup semifinals. On the other hand, Ghana bounced back from their 2-1 loss to Senegal at the start of their Nations Cup campaign and have gone from strength to strength, beating Guinea 3-0 in the quarterfinals. Although Ghana play in their fourth consecutive Nations Cup semifinal, defender Jonathan Mensah says they will not treat their opponents lightly.
Still going to continue our hard work, and we just focus on our target. We start off with a loss, but we came back really strong and get into where we want to be. We just taking it game after game, so we've qualified to the semifinals. We're just going to relax the body and just focus on the next game.
That was Jonathan Mensah, Ghanaian defender, speaking in Malabo.
I asked our African football guru, David Legg, how he sees Thursday evening's Equatorial Guinea-Ghana Nations Cup semifinal.
Well, the way I see this one, Sonny, is it's very tempting to say it's going to be a mismatch, and that is that Ghana, who are so far ahead of Equatorial Guinea in the FIFA rankings, 31 places in Africa, and a staggering 81 places in the world rankings, they've got to be strong favourites. But, I mean, as we saw in the quarterfinals when Equatorial Guinea shocked Tunisia, albeit in controversial circumstances, you cannot take anything for granted. And clearly the Equatorial Guineans, they're on a high at the moment. I mean, they started the tournament with two draws, were not particularly impressive. Many people felt that they would lose to Gabon and go out of the tournament, but they actually won by 2-0. They finished runners-up in the group. And then again, against Tunisia, they were outsiders, but they came from behind and they won it. With home advantage, the stadium, Estadio de Malabo, is bound to be packed to its 15,000 capacity. My understanding is that the president of Equatorial Guinea, Teodoro Obiang, he will be there to support the boys. And yeah, anything is possible, particularly, Sonny, if the Equatorial Guineans get their noses in front. But if you look at the two teams, I mean, it looks rather one-sided. You would have to side with Ghana. I'm going with Ghana. I'm basing it, I guess, on the fact that they've recovered well. They lost their first match to Senegal, but then they've since beaten Algeria, South Africa, and then comprehensively outplayed Guinea in the quarterfinals, winning by 3-0. And the third goal from Christian Atsu was certainly a contender for goal of the tournament. So, Sonny, I think on form, you would have to go for an Ivory Coast-Ghana final.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game on. This is cool. Just come out and play with me.
This is cool.
Just come out and play with me.
This is cool.
Just come out and play with me.
This is cool.
Hey.
This is cool.
Just come out and play with me.
This is cool.
Just come out and play with me.
This is cool.
Just come out and play with me.
This is cool.
We got the game on.
Game on. VOA sports fans, just ahead, my Voice of America colleague James Buddy will have a sporty Black History Month segment for February 5th.
Well,
this day in 1934, Henry Louis Hank Aaron was born in Mobile, Alabama. He became baseball's all-time home run hitter. Aaron entered the record books on April 8, 1974, when he broke Babe Ruth's record of 714 home run hits. He went on to hit a total of 755 home runs before completing his 23-year major league career. On this day in 1972, Robert Bob Douglas became the first African-American to be inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. Douglas was the founder of the New York Renaissance basketball team. Nicknamed the father of black professional basketball, Douglas owned and coached the Rens from 1923 to 1949.
That's the late great godfather of soul, James Brown, who died in 2006 at age 73. And James Brown provides the theme music throughout the month of February to my colleague James Buddy's Black History Month segments. In pro basketball, the Atlanta Hawks continue to soar to new heights this NBA season. Playing at home in Atlanta Wednesday night, the Hawks beat my favorite NBA club, the Washington Wizards, by a score of 105-96. Guard Jeff Teague, who will play in the annual NBA All-Star Game on February 15th in New York City, had 26 points and 8 assists for the Hawks. And teammate Al Horford, who was also selected for the All-Star Game, chipped in 21 points and 13 rebounds. John Wall, who will start at guard for the Eastern Conference in the All-Star Game, led the Wizards with 24 points, while backcourt partner Bradley Beal had 23 points. The Hawks had a 19-game winning streak snapped by the New Orleans Pelicans on Monday night. With their victory over the Wizards, they improved to 41 wins and 9 losses for the season. Washington, meanwhile, now has a record of 31 victories and 19 defeats. Elsewhere around the NBA, guard Russell Westbrook, who also will play in the All-Star Game, tied a career high with 45 points to lead the Oklahoma City Thunder to a 102-91 victory over host New Orleans. Oklahoma City star Kevin Durant sat out for the fourth time in the past 5 games with a toe injury. We hope KD gets back on the basketball court soon. The Memphis Grizzlies won their 8th game in a row, beating the host Utah Jazz 100-90. Zach Randolph had 18 points and 11 rebounds for the Grizzlies. James Harden fired in 27 points for the Houston Rockets as they beat the Chicago Bulls 101-90. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, South Sudan signs a deal with Kenya to set up fiber optic cable connecting the two countries. And next, China signs a deal to develop road, rail, and air transport routes to link African capitals. But first, some music. Here is Jimmy B of Sierra Leone with Jika Jika.
Gitate, ungise gude, gitate, gisakaya, gisakaya. Take me away, hey. Jimmy B.
Yeah, baby.
Jimmy B. Now drop the bomb on me.
Bring it on, bring it on.
the best in your fist. Check the jump for 95, stay alive and keep the pick. It's time to wreck it and get the bottom drinking. The nicotinamines and the house that I'm drinking. Jungle with us, your heart is how I hit him. If the sucker step up, then it's the most I gotta get him. No sweat, the technique and draw while I wreck this. I know you like the flavor, yo, cause you're selected. Crank it up, cause the jam is kinda cool. Don't pick the move, let them know you're in the groove. Forget all your worries, make up quick in a hurry. Go out, enjoy yourself, no time to get boring.
Is on till the break of dawn. I got to have it like a rabbit. Dropping mad skills, like the bills and through the rhythm. I'm an addict. I get rocks to hip hop. All the real niggas to the top and I'm stopped. This jam is like a trigger. We are keep it booming in your trunk and it's on. Now bring it on.
Jimmy B of Sierra Leone with Jika Jika.
Well, South Sudan has signed a deal with Kenya to set up fiber optic cable connecting the two countries for telecommunications. South Sudan officials say the move will not only boost communication, but improve the country's infrastructure and trade. For VOA, Magumbe Davis Rakawingi reports from Juba.
The agreement was signed by Rebecca Joshua Okwachi, South Sudan's Minister of Telecommunications and Postal Services, and her Kenyan counterpart, Fred Mathiang in Nairobi, Engineer Juma Stephen Luga, an undersecretary in the Ministry of Telecommunications, says the cable will be laid from Kenya's coastal town of Eldoret to Juba. Luga says once the project is completed, it will increase the speed of internet and cut in half South Sudan's cost of internet and communications service.
Paying bandwidth for the visa also is expensive. The traffic will go to Europe and from Europe come back to South Sudan. So this is how we are communicating currently. But using fiber, we can communicate direct to the region here without going to Europe.
He says the project will cost around $15 million. The World Bank is funding the upgrade. Luga says with fiber optic cable, South Sudanese will no longer have to travel to other continents for important medical consultations.
We can have a consultant in India also can do the work through this technology so that our doctors here can consult any doctor outside the country in the U.S. or in Europe, in India, for any medical operation even. It can be done online.
And fiber optic has other applications such as enabling video conferences. Luga says that will benefit the education sector.
A student can be in South Sudan and can study a university outside South Sudan. That is where they use fiber to access libraries, to access any information or the university. And even a lecturer can lecture outside the country in U.S. or in Europe or somewhere else, and the student will be in South Sudan.
He says the fiber optic cable will be laid along the road network connecting South Sudan and Kenya, which will also be improved.
We are working together and coordinating with the Ministry of Road because road also will facilitate transportation of goods in and outside South Sudan.
Most goods coming to South Sudan from Kenya are carried through Uganda, covering long distances, which drives up the cost of most goods from Kenya. Luga says this project should be finished in 2 years. For VOA News, I am Mugumedevs Ruakarinj in Juba.
The African Union and China recently signed a memorandum of understanding that the Chinese are dubbing the project of the century. The deal aims to develop road, rail, and air transport routes to link African capitals. Reporter Sandra Niara has the details from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
The African Union Commission Chairperson, Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, and Mr. Zhang Ming, the Special Envoy of the Chinese Government and Vice Foreign Minister of China, signed the memorandum that will see China help Africa develop high-speed rail, linking all 54 countries through high-speed railway, aviation, road highways, and industrialization infrastructure. Dlamini-Zuma said, although there are some historical ties between Africa and China, this mammoth project is the first of its kind between China and Africa at continental level. She said it will help Africans develop and deal with issues of joblessness, poverty, and related issues.
Amongst the things we've agreed on is also to train so that we have the skills both to deal with all the areas. So this is really the most substantive project the AU has ever had with any partner.
Mr. Zhang dubbed the Memorandum of Understanding the document of the century, adding, though ambitious and broad, the project was feasible. He said it would change the face of Africa, especially as economies in most African countries continue to improve. He said China has enough expertise and knowledge on high-speed rail, road transportation, and related issues that will help change the lives of ordinary people. In aviation, for example, Mr. Zhang said travel hubs will be created, cutting the existing code that sees Africans traveling within the continent having to go to the west first to catch connecting flights back to Africa.
I still remember during the meeting between my premier and Madame Zuma, Madame Zuma mentioned that the African people have a dream of having the day when all the 54 African capitals will be linked by high-speed rail.
The two refused to quantify the cost of the project, but Dlamini-Zuma said teams on the ground were still to come up with a figure, working out financing modalities and related issues. She said a nucleus of teams has already been put in place to work on high-speed rail, aviation, and industrialization, with teams already working in the countries in which the project will begin. Meanwhile, the AU chairperson, in outlining the AU summit agenda to journalists, said one of the most important issues outside terrorism, conflict in a number of countries, and peace and security that heads of state will discuss this week is the funding of the Pan-African body.
There's flexibility in terms of what countries, what mechanisms countries can use to get those resources. Some countries may decide that they'll just pay directly from their fiscus. There's no problem with that. The reason we even went into looking at alternate sources of funding is that some countries were saying it would not be possible for them to increase the contribution if it's based only on their fiscus.
She said alternative sources of funding need to be secured for the AU, with member states contributing more. The AU needs more predictable funding from member states in addition to what is coming in from donor organizations. President Robert Mugabe is expected to attend the summit with other African leaders. He is also expected to assume the chairmanship of the AU. Reporting from Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, I'm Sandra Nyairam.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Audrey Swigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The International Coalition to Counter the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, continues to grow in size and effectiveness. More than 60 nations have joined the coalition to support Iraq in the fight against ISIL. Iraq's coalition partners, said Special Presidential Envoy for the Global Coalition to Counter ISIL, General John Allen, are providing far more than military support. They are taking leading roles to stop the flow of foreign fighters, to limit ISIL's financing, to provide humanitarian assistance to its victims, and to defeat ISIL where they can do incredible harm, and that is in the virtual space, in the marketplace of ideas. Nations from Morocco to Germany and Kuwait are helping to steer these efforts. On the military side, 12 countries of the coalition have committed to train Iraq security forces at several locations across Iraq, an effort that is now well underway, said General Allen. And 8 coalition partners are also participating in airstrikes over Iraq, coordinating their support with Iraqi leadership on the ground. The Iraqi government has taken critical steps towards reform, and in response, the United States has increased its support for Iraq's security forces. The U.S. recently delivered 250 mine-resistant, armor-protected vehicles. This will significantly contribute to the mobility of Iraqi forces, said General Allen, and protect allies' military operations. This contribution was in addition to a $500 million investment in small arms and ammunition, which was delivered last year. In December, the U.S. appropriated $1.6 billion to train and equip Iraqi security forces for the future. Iraq is on the front lines of global conflict, as was demonstrated in the recent bloody terrorist attack in Paris. Before that, terrorists struck in Sydney, Ottawa, and Brussels. Clearly, ISIL is a global threat, said General Allen, that demands a global response. And that is why the world is coming together to support the brave Iraqis on the front line fighting this terrible enemy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right